Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for your attention. And the first one I'm going to ask of Dr. Weitz, do we currently have any criteria for patients failing eculizumab, and when do we decide to stop therapy? Dr. Weitz?
Well, number one, you need to decide what do you mean by failing? So if you're saying that the patient's LDH is not coming down, and they're still transfusion dependent. So it depends on your criteria. It's very rare to see that the LDH has knocked down with adjustment of eculizumab or ravulizumab dose, especially with ravulizumab. Very difficult, very rare to see that the patient hasn't responded. But there are a few patients. Some of them have a polymorphism in C5 that should be very evident very early, within the first month or so. But there are only a handful of those patients. Second, if the patient remains transfusion dependent, that's very worrisome. And especially if they have a high retic count, those patients definitely should be considered for an alternative therapy. The question is, what about those patients who are in between? They're not transfusion dependent, but they're still anemic. If they're feeling bad, they may be candidates for switching to an alternative therapy.
And Dr. Weitz, at this time, the alternative therapy that we routinely use is pegcetacoplan.
Yes, that's the only other approved complement inhibitor. So, and anybody who has a persistent anemia, in the clinical trials, they used a cutoff of 10, hemoglobin of 10, but anybody who's still symptomatic with an anemia, or those who are transfusion dependent, definitely should be considered for switching. But you should also make sure they have an adequate retic count and that they have C3b on their cells.
Yeah, so I think this is a question about eculizumab. There are some people who have breakthrough at the end of the dosing interval, and for those patients, as we discussed at length in our previous presentation, sometimes it's worthwhile to consider switching to a longer acting form of a C5 inhibitor like ravulizumab, and those patients can derive benefit from that. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And you can identify that if the LDH is normalized on day 8 and then it pops up at day 15, that's suggestive that they're breaking through, because eculizumab has a very short half-life. So going to ravulizumab, the C5 levels are suppressed immediately, and they stay down for the full 8 weeks. I do have a few patients who break through right at the end of their ravu dose at week 8. So and it's within the label, they get their dose every 7 weeks.
Yeah, I have a few patients like that too. So the next question here that we received was, do patients stay on treatment for life? And I have a couple of patients I'll just start with, and I'll ask you what your opinions are. I've had a couple of patients where we serially monitor their PNH clone size. And I've had some patients where that clone has diminished to the extent that it's no longer clinically relevant or significant. So I had one patient who had an antecedent history of an aplastic anemia, who received immunosuppressive therapy, had a really nice response, but then had a pretty large PNH clone. And then sequentially, evaluation of the PNH clone showed decrease in the size to less than 5% with no evidence of ongoing intravascular hemolysis. And we made the decision to take him off therapy, and he's doing well. And we continue to monitor his PNH clone size, but he's been able to stay off. Do you have similar stories?
I have only one patient who was not on treatment, but her clone size decreased from 40% to 20% as her marrow failed. And then when she recovered mostly with more normal cells and never went on treatment. But I haven't had any patient on treatment whose clone size has decreased. I know the people at Leeds have patients in whom the clone size decreased. Almost all of those patients, they had to put back on treatment when they stopped.
Hmm. So I actually have a patient who I recently elected to hold treatment. He had a history of aplastic anemia as a child, and then had started on eculizumab for years and years, and was on since its initial approval. And then more recently, his clone size now has fallen to less than 10%, and he really wanted to come off. And so we've been monitoring. We continue to monitor him every 6 months and follow his clone.
What was his clone when you started him?
I didn't start him again. He started before I graduated from my residency. Yes. But at that time, he had a very large clone, and he had clinically Coca-Cola colored urine and recurrent breakthrough hemolysis. Well, for him, it was wonderful. But he's now in his late 40s. And he was originally diagnosed as a kid. And he did really, really well. And initially, when I started seeing him, his clone size was in the 60, 70% range. And he was doing great. And then recently, his clone size has fallen. Is now less than 10%. And he has still a degree of bone marrow failure. So he stays on low dose prednisone. 5 milligrams, but he actually has platelets running at 100. His hemoglobin runs in the 11 gram range right now, and his white count is stable, and he looks great and feels well and is happy to be off therapy.
Well, I think there are patients like that, and we know that patients with PNH can evolve out of aplastic anemia, and aplastic anemia can evolve from PNH, so they can go in and out, and you just need to monitor the patient.
I mean, for me, what that speaks to is the importance of the serial monitoring order on those patients, and how important it is to be aware of how patients are feeling and to take clinical history like that. So the next question is, are there any issues to be aware of when switching patients from eculizumab to ravulizumab? And I think probably, Dr. Weitz, you have a lot of experience with this. I've done a couple, but I would love to hear what you think.
Yeah, we haven't had any issues. I have had a couple of patients who did not do as well with Ravu as they did with Ecu. And these patients were very, very heavily C3B loaded, and they have since gone on to other therapies. But the vast majority of patients, it's very easy. You just start the patient when they'd be due for their next Ecu dose, you start them on Ravu. 2 weeks later, you load them. 2 weeks later, you put them on the maintenance dose, and most of them never look back.
And how far away do you think we are from an oral agent for PNH?
Well, the Factor B trial has been completed, so that's being adjudicated, and I suspect next year we will see the Factor B available. The Factor D was an overlap trial. My own personal feeling is I don't think anybody wants to take two drugs. So they're working on a different formulation for that. It can be standalone. And the BioCryst Factor D, which is standalone, hit a little roadblock because of some toxicity. So that's on hold or just resuming now.
Okay, so potentially sometime next year, we hope.
We think so.
Okay, and then the last question is, when should we consider bone marrow transplant for PNH?
So there aren't any firm or fixed rules, and you do a lot more bone marrow transplants than I do, but my rule of thumb is, number one, if they have aplastic anemia with a PNH clone, you're going to treat the aplastic anemia. So if they are not responding to immunosuppressive therapy and they have a large PNH clone, that's something to consider bone marrow transplant, because the aplastic anemia is the primary event. Second, if they're very young, they will have a lifetime of this disease. Why do we want to go there? So I think in very young patients, I would be much more aggressive in pursuing a donor for if they have AA, but also if they have hemolytic PNH. Finally, if they have recurrent thromboses in spite of treatment and in spite of anticoagulation, which is extremely rare, then they would be considered candidates. I think the antithrombotic effect of complement inhibition is very dramatic and not like, it's not likely that these patients are going to progress through.
Yeah, I currently have a patient in our practice who's been really challenging and has had a lot of breakthrough hemolysis and continues to have a lot of problems, had a pretty extensive thrombosis at initial presentation and continues to have a lot of problems. And so she's relatively younger, relatively fit. And so she continues to be transfusion dependent, continues to have episodes of breakthrough hemolysis. And so in her case, even though I hate to do it, I think we're strongly considering a bone marrow transplant. But again, I would agree it's relatively rare. I had a couple of additional patients who I did send. I had a patient who had aplastic anemia, who had a history of aplastic anemia as a child, who then developed PNH and was maintained on complement inhibitor therapy for a long time, did well, but then developed anemias and a bone marrow showed, although he did not have MDS overtly in the marrow, but he had developed a clonal cytogenetic abnormality. And so in him, we took him to transplant just to forestall the potential for development of a secondary hematologic malignancy. And then I had another patient who, again, had very profound progressive cytopenias, had received several courses of immunosuppressive therapy, had really progressive PNH as well. And so we took him to transplant, and he's done well with a haploidentical donor.
Yeah, we've done a couple. We had one who had MDS, and because she had underlying MDS with some cytogenetic abnormalities, we felt her risk of progressing was higher, progressing to leukemia or MDS, and she had a sibling match, identical match. She's done very well. We've had a couple others. We did a couple of haplos in. One died of a fungal infection, which was very unfortunate, but the others have done okay. So, I mean, it's not without complications. The issue, the biggest issue is finding adequate donors. And, but, you know, with techniques for transplant today, they're much safer than they were 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's also some nice data from the group out in, in Washington State, suggesting that using C5 inhibitor therapy right up to the time of transplant seems to mitigate a lot of the previous problems that we had in the past with graft-versus-host disease in people with PNH. I think there are case series that showed very, very high rates of GVHD in people who had active hemolysis at the time they went for transplant. So I think the one nuance from my practice is that I always make sure that people are early post-treatment when they go for their transplant so that they get their C5 inhibitor the day before they go for admission for their conditioning to try and make sure they minimize complement activation at a time when their bone marrow production is likely to be involved with Pig A deficient cells. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think the other thing is that there's a high incidence of thrombosis with the preparatory regimens if you don't take them through on complement inhibition. And now with Ravu, all they need is one dose and it lasts for 8 weeks. So they're going to have recovered by then.
Right. Oh, so that's exactly the point.
Like, you don't have to do anything.
Before, what I used to do is I would give them eculizumab through the first 90 days of therapy and continue with eculizumab. And now I just give the RAV the day before they get
ready. Right.
Okay, fantastic. All right, thank you so much for your attention today. I hope you felt that this session was valuable.
Thanks, everyone.